Well, good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. It's good to get back to this book of Daniel, which I think it's been over 6 months since we last looked at it. And I find, as Brother James says, this chapter before us tonight, chapter 7, is a foundation chapter. As chapter 2 of Daniel, we might say, is a foundation chapter for the book of Daniel. We might say that chapter 7 of Daniel is a foundation for the book of Revelation. And I find this chapter particularly exciting and interesting, brothers and sisters. If we can get our heads around this, then we're well positioned to understanding some of those prophetic chapters in the book of Revelation. I might say at the outset, it's a real challenge to get through this chapter in one night. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just skip over some parts of it. And the details of that are in a handout out the front. If you like, send me an email and I'll send you a soft copy of it if you'd prefer that. So there'll be some sections that I'll just say we're referring to the handout. That's pretty much the only way we're going to get through all of this tonight. Well, if Daniel was 17 when he entered Babylon, he's probably around the age of 70 now when he received the vision in chapter 7. It's been 18 long years since Nebuchadnezzar received the vision in chapter 4. And it's been 50 years since Nebuchadnezzar received the vision in chapter 2. So it's been a long time since Daniel was given that foundation prophecy back in chapter 2. This is the first of a number of visions that Daniel was given. And it was a bittersweet experience. He perceived that from this vision in chapter 7 that the redemption of his people was going to come after a long period of persecution. And the result of that was to make Daniel feel physically ill. As we read in verse 28, my cogitations or my thoughts troubled me and my countenance changed. You could see that this man looked ill after he had received this vision because he understood, brothers and sisters and young people, just what this meant for his brothers and sisters. And perhaps to help us to appreciate that, when we read this chapter and we read the word saints, perhaps we could replace that with brothers and sisters at Tea Tree Gully. He personally empathised with these saints who he would have realised, by the way, were not his own natural people, the Jews. These were the Gentile saints that he was reading about in this chapter. And so it's interesting that God reveals to Daniel the destiny of the Gentile saints in chapter 7 before he reveals the destiny, if you like, of his own people in chapter 8. We're going to spend about 2 minutes just reviewing the book overall. Some of you may not have been at our first class, just to help us put in context where we are in the book of Daniel. You might recall the book is broken up into two distinct halves, chapters 1 to 6 and 7 to 12, and there are both parallels and contrast between those two halves. I'm not going to go through all of these comparisons, these points of comparison, comparison. But just to note this, that the first six chapters we might summarise as the contest of wills, the sovereignty of God in our affairs, and the second half, the contest for the world, the sovereignty of God in world affairs. And perhaps out of all those points of comparison, the one that I find most interesting is this, that in the first six chapters, it reveals a development by trial of the saints to receive the kingdom of God. And in the second half, it reveals the development by aggression of the kingdom of men to receive the judgments of God. Is there a theme that ties these two halves together? I think there is. This theme, to him that overcometh, will I grant to sit with me in my throne. In the first half of the book, that theme is, if you like, outworked in the lives of individuals. In the second half of the book, that same theme is outworked in the body of believers. When were the prophecies given? As we said, it's been over 50 years. Some of us haven't even lived that long. Since Nebuchadnezzar received the vision in chapter 2, which Daniel interpreted, and 18 years since he received, since Nebuchadnezzar received the vision in chapter 4. But from now on, it's all visions given to Daniel. And it's going to be Gabriel is the one that's doing the interpreting, not Daniel. And you can see they're all fairly well bunched up as Daniel approaches the end of his life. So what's the relationship between chapter 7 and the other prophetic chapters in the second half of the book? I think it's important that we understand this. First of all, let's just reflect on chapter 2. We've got to get chapter 2 clear in our mind. We probably tend to think of it as some sort of historical account of the kingdoms of men, you know, with the kingdom of Babylon, Medo-Persians, Greeks, etc. But that's not really what chapter 2 is about. In chapter 2, what we're given is sufficient information about these kingdoms that once existed so that we can recognise the time of the end when there will be a single kingdom that incorporates the gold, silver, brass and iron when it's about to be smitten by the stone. So I want you to understand that what we're looking at in chapter 2 is the latter day manifestation of a single kingdom on the earth. What is the relationship of the other prophetic chapters to that? Well, you see, all of these chapters, 7 and 8 and 10 and 11, have a climax. And the climax is chapter 2, the end of the kingdom of men. So the logical question then is, why do we have three parallel accounts of the same sort of thing? They all terminate at the same point in time. Well, of course, they have each has a different emphasis. In chapter 7, we're going to learn about the kingdom of men in relation to the saints. Chapter 8, the kingdom of men in relation to God's people, the Jews. And finally, in chapters 10 and 11, the kingdom of men in relation to God's land. Why is that so? Well, you see, those things, the saints, the people and the land, are the means by which God is going to make himself known at the end of the kingdom of men. Now, let me give you an illustration of that. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 38 quickly. And you'll see what I mean. Ezekiel 38 picks up on the last two of these, the people and the land. So it's in connection with these three things, the saints, the people and the land, that God will make himself known to the world at the time of the end. Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 16. This is, of course, speaking of Gog, and I'm going to emphasise a couple of words in this verse. And thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the nations may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. And what's the result of God making himself known in this way? Verse 23. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. And what's interesting is, when we think about chapter 7 and 8 in particular, chapter 7, as we're going to see, reveals the development of a religious aspect of the kingdom of men, and in chapter 8, the military aspect. And what's interesting is that the force which defeats those two powers, the religious and the military ones, the titles given to the saints, is chosen particularly. So going back to Daniel, for example, in chapter 7, you'll notice that it's the holy ones, or the saints, that are going to bring to an end the religious aspect of the kingdom of men. But note the difference in chapter 8, where chapter 8 emphasises the military aspect of the kingdom of men at the time of the end. And it's not the holy ones that will bring that power to an end. It's the princes. And they're led by the prince of princes. You know, what this is telling us is that when the kingdom of men takes things that belong to God, he acts. In chapter 7, they took the lives of his saints. In chapter 8, they took away his people and his sanctuary. In chapter 11, they took away his land. And in chapter 7, it's Yahweh's day of vengeance for taking away the lives of his saints. How would we break up chapter 7? Here's a suggested breakup. Verses 1 to 8 is about the four beasts themselves, about how they arose and their ascendancy. Verses 9 to 12 is the judgment of those four beasts. Verses 13 to 14 is a complete change in scene. And when you first read those two verses, you sort of think, well, how does that fit into the rest of the chapter? And actually, it's quite simple. It's really introducing, or it's telling us about the inauguration of what we might call the fifth kingdom, the kingdom of heaven. Verses 15 to 18 is the angelic synopsis of the vision, and verses 19 to 28 is a response to Daniel's request to know more about the fourth beast. You know, one of the things that we can take away from this, brothers and sisters, is when you read this chapter and the imagery and the symbology, it's not easy to understand. Daniel saw this vision firsthand and he didn't understand it. And he made a passionate plea to the angel, please tell me more. And the takeaway from that, brothers and sisters and young people, is this, that as one person put it, the truth is not for hobbyists. We have to have a passion to find out the answer to these things. And, you know, I find it absolutely remarkable how God has recorded this in such a way that a casual reader just can't get it. It's all there. But a casual reader is not going to pick it up. He has to be prepared, and we have to be prepared, to do some hard yards to understand this and to have the passion and determination as Daniel did. Well, the vision of chapter 7, as we're told in verse 1, was given in the first year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the fifth Babylonian king that Daniel had seen on the throne, and he was going to be the last. And by this time, as you might recall, during Belshazzar's reign, Daniel is now being deposed from his role as chief of the magicians. But God hadn't finished his work with him. In verse 2, where Daniel beholds four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. These winds that we read of are really a metaphor, if you like, for angelic supervision or angelic orchestration. They're controlling the affairs of mankind. And you might like to make a note that in Revelation 7 and verse 1, these winds are said to be held by the angels. And the expression four winds of heaven is a common expression, indicating that the control of the winds is at the hand of the angels. And an example of that sort of control, if you quickly flick over to chapter 11, verse 1, here it is. Also, I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him. They're the words of the angel, controlling those winds of heaven to bring about the purpose of God. And that's comforting, brothers and sisters, to know that despite the seemingly lack of control in the affairs of the world and the questionable integrity of those that rule the world, it's in God's control. As our opening hymn 91 aptly says, nations in rage, the suffering earth divide, yet all unknown, he rules their ceaseless fray. Verse 3 tells us that these four great beasts were to come up out of the sea. It's referred to as the Great Sea in verse 2. It's referring to the Mediterranean. If you like to make a note of Numbers 34 and verse 6, Joshua 1 verse 4, the Great Sea is the Mediterranean. So what's this telling us? It's telling us that these beasts that Daniel saw were going to border the Mediterranean. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to assume that the four beasts that we're reading about here are parallel to the four metals in the image. I was intending to have that on the handout for tonight, but I just ran out of time. I might include that before I send around the soft copy. I'm going to take that as a given. We just don't have time to establish that tonight. Before we get into the details of these beasts, I want to make some general comments about beasts that help us to interpret them. Some of the features that we read of the beasts were only relevant for certain phases. It's important to know that. Some of the features were relevant to the beginning, the mid, or the end of the phases of the beast. For example, the lion had wings only in its early phase. The foreheads of the leopard relate to its mid-phase. The brazen claws of the fourth beast, latter phase. Think of it this way. If you're asked to do a sketch of your garden, hopefully it's not a garden that looks like ours and it's got flowers, but let's say your garden's got flowers, and you're doing a sketch of it in, you know, spring, summer, autumn, winter, same garden, four sketches, they're all going to look different, aren't they? In one sketch you're going to have blossoms, in another you're not. Well, imagine trying to incorporate four seasons in one image. Some of the features of the beast we're reading about are relevant for various phases. The first beast, verse 4, the lion. Now the key to understanding this lion is its wings. What do the wings represent? Let's go to Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 8 just quickly. Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 8, what we're going to read about there is a verse about the invasion of Babylon by the king of Assyria. Isaiah 8 verse 8, and he shall pass through Judah and shall overflow and go over, and he shall reach even unto the neck. This is the king of Assyria mentioned in verse 7. And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. So his wings therefore represent the extent of his dominion. So if the stretching out of his wings represents the gaining of dominion, what do you think the plucking of wings represents? Well, it's the removal or the loss of dominion. Now, if we apply that to the first beast, and we think it's just referring to the kingdom of Babylon, we've got a problem. Because you see, during the 70-year period of the kingdom of Babylon, it didn't have its wings plucked. What's the answer? The answer is that the lion represents the Assyrian Empire in two phases. The first phase was when its capital was in Nineveh, and the second phase was when its capital was in Babylon. Now, both of those phases are represented by lions. We won't turn it up, but Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 17 makes that clear. It talks about both the king of Assyria and the king of Babylon as being lions. So the important question is then, why does Daniel take us back to, you know, one kingdom further, if you like, before Babylon in chapter 7, which he didn't do in chapter 2? I think simply this, that he wants to take us back to the roots, the very roots of the kingdom of men, which began in Assyria when Nimrod built both Babel and Nineveh. What became of the Assyrian Empire? Well, you see, it was overthrown. It was divided between Cyaxares, the Mede, and Nabopolassar, the Babylonian. Media annexed the north and northeast, and Babylon took the south and southwest. And so what we have to represent that is the plucking of wings. And how suitable is the imagery that Daniel uses to represent those beasts? The winged lion was commonplace in the palaces of the Assyrian palaces. And similarly, the lion was commonplace in Babylon. In fact, this lion we see depicted here lined the processional way, as it was called. It's an entrance into Babylon. And you may notice, might be a bit hard to see from down the back. Can you see what that is? It's a wing. It's like a little wing. So whereas the Assyrian Empire was represented by this lion with quite significant wings, the Babylonian kingdom was also represented by a lion, almost, you might say, with wings plucked. Now we're told in verse 4 that the Babylonian dynasty, for the most part, was more humane. It was more civilised than the Assyrian. A man's heart was given to the lion. So you might put it this way, that the Assyrians tried to take off your head, the Babylonians tried to change what was inside it. The second beast, the bear, in verse 5. Now, that was going to be of particular interest to Daniel because, you see, it represented the dominion that was going to surpass the Babylonian dominion that he was present in. We know that the Babylonian Empire was replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire when Cyrus conquered Babylon. So why are the Medes and the Persians represented by one animal, by the bear? Well, quite simply this, that they were allied, and they were allied by marriage. Cyrus the Persian king was the nephew of Darius the Mede. Now, the bear is said to be lifted up on one side. Why? Simply because the Medes rule for 2 years, the Persians rule for 200, and the Persian dominion or dynasty was more dominant. And the Persian dynasty was rapacious. It was, as we're told in verse 5, told to devour much flesh at the end of verse 5. And it had three ribs in its mouth. Why three? Well, as chapter 8 and verse 4 tells us, the ram, which is another symbol for this empire, pushed westward, northward and southward. So those three military campaigns correspond to the three ribs in the mouth of the bear. These ribs were the tokens of devoured territories. The third beast in verse 6 is the leopard. Now actually, I don't know what happened. I had a slide after this one and I've somehow managed to delete it, which is a shame, because what I found really interesting was in the corresponding chapter, in chapter 4, where we've got the three animals, what we find is that the Persian emperor is actually, or in chapter 8, the Persia is represented by a ram. Okay, what you find is that the Persian kings actually had headdress which included ram's horns on them. I don't know what I did with the slide, but it's gone into the ethernet somewhere. Okay, where was I? The next kingdom, the Greeks. The third beast provides further details of the Greek Empire. The leopard's got four heads. Why? Simply that when Alexander the Great died, he commenced the Grecian Empire, that his dominion was divided between his four generals. It didn't go to his offspring. And they didn't... It wasn't a case of four working together to rule one dominion. The dominion is split up into four. Hence, there were four wings representing four dominions and four heads over each of those dominions, a head representing a form of government. Now, what's really interesting is this. Or perhaps just to point out those four empires. So going clockwise around the Mediterranean, we've got this, they're colour-coded. So we've got the dominion of Cassander. These are Alexander's four generals. The dominion of Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, the big area, and Ptolemy's, the area of Egypt. Now, what I want to bring to your attention is this, that this Grecian empire, notice how far it extended to the east, a huge empire. It extended all the way across to the Indus River. And I want you to take particular note of that area that I've highlighted in yellow. And the reason is because that was not conquered by the fourth beast in its early Roman Empire phase. You might like to make a note of that. We're going to come back to that. So just try and visualise that area, which, if you like, includes part of Syria, Iran, Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, we've seen how the lions were a fitting symbol of Assyria and Babylonia. The leopard is a fitting symbol of Greece. Have a look at this. That's a depiction of Alexander the Great. What do you notice about his horse? It's got a leopard skin. Incredible, isn't it? Now, look at this. This is a depiction of Alexander's father, Philip of Macedon. What do you notice about his horse? It's got a leopard on it. And so what we find is that the leopard was actually part of the regalia of the kings of Greece in battle. So in verses 7 and 8, we have a description of the fourth beast. Now, the fourth beast, what we're told in those two verses, is pretty much repeated in verses 19 to 20, so we're not going to deal with it here. We're just going to read it quickly, but only for the purpose of introducing us to verses 9 to 12. So verses 7 and 8, I might just pause for a drink before I do. And I'm sorry, I know I am going through this fairly paced, but bear with me, it's the only way we're going to get through this chapter tonight. Verses 7 and 8, and after this I saw in the night visions, and behold a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces. It stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. So having seen this vision of the four beasts arise out of the sea, Daniel is now taken to the time when their dominion will be taken away. Now, Daniel could have simply been told, Daniel, these four kingdoms are going to come to an end. But he's not. He's given a vision of the judgment in verses 9 to 12 that he was going to be part of. What a consolation, brothers and sisters and young people, to be reassured, Daniel, even though you've seen these four horrible beasts, which are going to rule the face of this earth for a long period of time, there's coming a time, Daniel, when you're going to have a work to do, and you're going to be involved in judging these beasts and taking their dominion from them. So the scene changes in verses 9 to 12. The turbulent seas with beasts emerging is replaced by a courtroom scene. And in this courtroom scene, there are judicial thrones. In verse 9, it says, I beheld till the thrones were cast down. Now, you need to make a note. That really gives the wrong impression. It should say, the thrones are set, as it should be. So these are the thrones of the saints being set ready for judgment. They're not earthly thrones. There is a presiding judge. He's titled the Ancient of Days, who enters the courtroom. And he's accompanied by a great multitude, thousands of thousands. And at the end of verse 10, it tells us that when the judiciary was set, that the books were opened. It's important to note that this judgment is not of the saints. This judgment is by the saints. How do we know that? Well, verses 21 and 22, if you like, are an interpretation of what we're reading here. Note what it says there. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. It takes place when the saints possess the kingdom, and their possession of the kingdom is evident by the fact that they are now judging. And the saints in this vision are represented by that multitude in verse 10. Now, the presiding judge is referred to as the Ancient of Days. We read that in verse 9. Who is this Ancient of Days? That expression occurs only 3 times, you know, in the Bible, and it's all in this chapter. It's a title, and it can apply to Yahweh himself, as it does in verse 13, or, as in the case of verses 9 and 22, it applies to Christ, who is a manifestation of him. Now, that's not a new idea to us, is it? We call that God manifestation. So in verse 9, the Ancient of Days is the presiding judge. It's Christ, who said, the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son. In verse 13, one like a Son of Man, that is Christ, and note the difference, in the AV it says, one like the Son of Man. In most other translations, it's one like a Son of Man, that is Christ, is brought before the Ancient of Days. And there the Ancient of Days is referring to Yahweh himself. Finally, in verse 22, the coming of the Ancient of Days is referring to Christ's return, when he will give power to the saints. So the question is, why in verses 9 and 22 is Christ referred to as the Ancient of Days rather than the Son of Man? Well, I think it's this, to emphasise that when Christ comes again, when he descends from heaven, that he's going to come in Yahweh's name and he's going to come with his power. To the scribes and Pharisees, Christ said, "Ye shall not see me henceforth till ye say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of Yahweh." And I believe in so saying that, brothers and sisters and young people, Christ was directing their attention to this very chapter as if to say, "My kingdom is not of this world, for I must ascend to my Father first, but I will come again. And when I come, it'll be in God's name and with God's power." Now, hence the title, as I said, of Ancient of Days is used with respect to both Yahweh himself and Christ. And you know, those two actually have a title in this chapter. They are the what the AV calls the Most High. You see that in verse 18, it occurs for the first time. You might like to make a note against that Most High in verse 18 and elsewhere where it occurs. It should be High Ones, plural. It's referring to Yahweh and to Christ. That High Ones appears in verse 18, 22, 25 and 27. Going back to verse 9 for a moment, the judgment scene. We're told four things about the presiding judge. He's got a white garment. He's got hair like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, and his wheels and the wheels were as burning fire. These things are telling us this. The judgment will take place by one who is worthy to judge. He's got a white garment. He's righteous. His judgment is going to be impeccable. Why? Because he's immortal. He has the authority to judge. Why? Because he's enthroned by God. And his judgments are going to be universal. The throne has wheels. And we read in verse 10 that a fiery stream issued and came forth from him. And that stream will consume the little horn and the fourth beast, just like it consumed Nadab and Abihu, who also offered false worship. Leviticus 10 verse 2. You know, the Son of Man, we're not told for no reason, brothers and sisters and young people, that his garment was white. The Son of Man was accounted worthy to judge because his garment was white. What about ours? You know, Paul said, "But we are sure that the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things. And thinkest thou this, O man, that judgest them which do such things and doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God?" There are qualifications, brothers and sisters and young people, for us to be part of that multitude that will be there with Christ. You know, our susceptibility to diminish the importance of having a white garment gave call for James to say, "Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widow in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." How do we keep ourselves unspotted from the world? You know, it's really very simple, although hard to do. It's by having a mind and a heart that says, "I don't want to do that." That's the only way I've found success, brothers and sisters and young people. It's not by willpower. It's by having a heart and a mind that says, "I don't want to think that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that." And that's the motive that will help us to keep our garments unspotted. So what's the context of this judgment? When is it? Who is being judged? And what's the crime? Well, in verse 11 we read, end of verse 10, the books were opened. What was found written in these books? Well, I'll tell you what was written in these books. That the little horn of the fourth beast had made war with the saints. In her was found the blood of prophets and of the saints. Her sins have reached unto heaven, and now God has remembered her iniquities. That's what's written in that little book. Well, who shall judge her? Verse 26, the saints. They shall take away her dominion. And what shall be done unto her? Reward her, even as she has rewarded you. Double unto her, double according to her works. Well, when will the judgment be executed? When she makes war with the Lamb. And then the Lamb shall overcome her. And in the words of Daniel 7 verse 11, the beast shall be slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And this is the judgment that's spoken of in Psalm 149 in verses 5 to 9. This honour have all the saints. So what then do we make to this next little section in verses 13 to 14? You know, Daniel beheld four beasts arise. They were all earthly. They were all carnal. We're told in verse 17 that they arose out of the earth. That's what it's telling us. These were carnal beasts. In verses 13 to 14, Daniel sees what we might call the beginning of the fifth kingdom, and its origin is heavenly. Verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. He sees one like a Son of Man escorted into the presence of the Father by an angelic host. You know, the apostles saw the commencement of that ascension in Acts chapter 1, didn't they? Now, in verse 14, we're told that there was given him dominion. In what sense was Christ, when he ascended to heaven, given dominion? Well, I'd like you to put your hand in Daniel 7. Let's quickly turn over to Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19 and verse 12. This is a parable that Christ spoke. He said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. Verse 15, and it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded the servants to be called unto him. So that's the sense in which Christ gains dominion or gains the kingdom when he ascends to heaven. Of course, he's going to come back to establish that kingdom, but in prospect, he's been given it. So we might title verses 13 and 14, the inauguration of Christ the King. The Apostle Peter says, Christ is gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels, authorities and powers being made subject unto him. You know, to the beasts were given dominion. To this man was given glory. Not just vainglory, brothers and sisters and young people, but the glory of the Father. And whereas the kingdom of the four beasts was terminal, this kingdom shall never be destroyed. Now, you know, it's apparent from verses 13 and 14 that Christ would not take the kingdom at his first advent. There would be an ascension first and then a return later. And you know what? The Jews never, ever got that. You know, Christ said to the Jewish rulers, to point this out, he said, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. In other words, there would be a going and there would be a coming from the right hand of power. In the remainder of the chapter, in verses 15 to 28, we have the truth of the fourth beast. The fourth beast arrested Daniel's attention more than the other beasts. And so he appeals to the angel to tell me more. He was particularly interested in this beast because it made war with the saints. And what's revealed of the fourth beast here really builds upon what's said of the fourth kingdom in Daniel chapter 2. So let's very briefly just review what we saw in Daniel chapter 2. The fourth kingdom followed the Grecian kingdom and began as the Roman Empire centred in Rome. Around 330 AD, Constantine moved the civil and military capital of the empire to Constantinople. Rome remained the headquarters of the religious centre of the church. In 395, the empire was formally divided between east and west with separate emperors. And that division is represented by the two iron legs. Well, what about the feet and toes? In 476, the Western Roman Empire fell to the barbaric tribes from the north and east. We know that 10 tribes came down and they established themselves as 10 individual sovereignties, if you like, on the old territory of the Western Roman Empire. Now, with the support of the emperors in Constantinople, so that's over in the east, and from the support from the Holy Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic power grew in magnitude and gained authority over the ten toe kingdoms. The Roman iron in the feet and the toes now acquired a religious character. In 1453, the Eastern Roman Empire fell to the Ottoman Turks. So what we're being told is at the time when the image is smitten, There will exist 10 sovereignties on the territory of the Western Roman Empire that are affiliated by Roman iron religion. Now, I might just go back. Sorry. And I want to just point out, remember how when we looked at the Grecian Empire, I pointed out that large expanse of territory east of Syria? Well, that was never conquered by Rome. They only went as far as, well, we might call it modern-day Jordan. Okay. The other thing to point out, which I should have when the map was up there, that none of the other empires, apart from the Roman Empire, conquered the territory pertaining to the Western Roman Empire. So from sort of Czechoslovakia across to the Atlantic, none of the previous beasts had conquered that territory, so that was unique to Rome. Now, what Daniel doesn't tell us, but what history does, is that in 1054 a schism took place, a schism which resulted in the formation of the Greek Orthodox religion in Constantinople. And when Constantinople fell, that religious centre moved to Moscow. And for that reason, Moscow has become known as the Third Rome. And the existence of those two churches, the Roman Catholic in the West and the Greek Orthodox now in Moscow, preserved the Babylonish religion. And that's signified to us by the band of brass and iron around the stump of the tree, as revealed in Daniel chapter 4. For ease of explanation, we're going to consider the fourth beast in three phases, just to try and keep it simple. Remember how he said, you know, you have seasons in your garden? Some of the features that we see in the beast pertain to various phases of the beast. So to explain the fourth beast, I'm going to do it in three phases. We're going to look at, first of all, the pre-little horn phase. Then we're going to look at the establishment of the little horn phase, and then the latter day phase. Now, we're told the fourth beast was diverse from all the other beasts. It was in so many ways. The first three beasts, you know, when you read the account of them, they're static. But the fourth beast is animated. It's devouring and breaking in pieces. It's stamping with its feet. It's plucking up three horns. It has a mouth speaking great things. So let's have a look at this fourth beast in the first of these phases before the little horn came up. So you'll see it. It doesn't have the little horn with the eyes and the mouth. And you've got to use your imagination here to imagine that there's 10 horns on this beast. Let's consider its characteristics. So first of all, it came up out of the sea. We've already considered that's telling us that the dominion bordered the Mediterranean. It's called the fourth kingdom, so it relates to the fourth kingdom in chapter 2. In both chapter 2 and chapter 7, the term fourth kingdom is used. So it's drawing our attention to the fact that these are the same entities. It devours and breaks in pieces with teeth of iron. What's that telling us? The beast would exercise dominion over the territory of the Roman Empire. Iron speaks of the dominion exercised by Rome and Constantinople. What about the 10 horns? 10 kings would exist within the beast's dominion. They equate to the 10 toes. Now, I want you to think about this. Put on your thinking caps for a moment. You've got the Western Roman Empire. So it's represented by this beast, Western Roman Empire. 10 barbaric tribes come down from the north and destroy that Western Roman Empire. Do you see something peculiar about the fact that those 10 barbaric tribes now form part of the beast? How can that be? They conquered the beast. How can they now be part of the beast? You see the point? So what's the answer? The answer is this. These 10 horns that conquered Rome's military power in the West later came under the dominion of another power of Rome, the religious power in the West. Do you see the point? If these powers hadn't come under the dominion of Rome's religious power, they could not have been incorporated in the beast, because the beast represents the dominion of Rome and Constantinople. And I find that quite a moment when I sort of come to realise that. You know, you just read that it's got 10 horns and you accept that, but hey, they're incorporated into the beast. So in summary, what does the fourth beast in its pre-little horn phase represent? The dominion exercised by Rome and Constantinople until the 5th century. And in the 5th century, the dominion exercised by Rome in the West changed from military to religious. And that transition of dominion leads us to the second phase of the beast, the establishment of the little horn phase. We've seen that the fourth beast in chapter 7 has a twin brother in the fourth kingdom of chapter 2. Both have a military power. Both have ten kings. It's reasonable to expect that they both have a religious power or a religious element, and they do. We want to find some correspondence to the religious iron in the feet and toes of the image. What are the attributes of the fourth beast that might indicate religious overtones? Well, it's a little horn, of course, isn't it? It blasphemes God. It persecutes the saints for a period which we shall see is 1260 years. So at this point, we've got two fingers pointing to the Roman Catholic Church. But there's further evidence outside Daniel that's indisputable. You know, much of Revelation is about the development of this little horn of the fourth beast. The beast of the sea, for example, in Revelation 13. The beast of the earth in Revelation 13. And the scarlet-coloured beast in Revelation 12. Unless we understand this little horn, we can't really grasp the significance of those beasts. But when we look at two of those other beasts that appear in Revelation, this is what we find. We're trying to establish the identity of this little horn. And this is what we find. That there's six attributes which occur in Revelation 13 and three of them in Revelation 17. It's all a development of the same Roman Catholic religious dominion. As in chapter 7, the little horn was part of a beast that had 10 horns. It rose up out of the sea. It blasphemed God. It has temporal power for 1260 years, persecutes the saints, and it's judged by the saints. What's the verdict? The little horn is undoubtedly the religious dominion exercised by Rome, the city on seven hills. You know, just to pause for a moment, brothers and sisters and young people, and consider this, that this power, this religious power, is styled a little horn. A little horn. It became and still is the greatest kingdom that the world has ever seen and ever will see. Think about it. The Hun kingdom, massive, you know, went from the Pacific to the Atlantic, but it come and went in 160 years. This system has lasted millennia. This horn of one is one of two little horns in Daniel. We might call this horn the religious little horn of the West. We're going to see next week in Daniel chapter 8, there is another little horn. It's the little military horn of the East. And what's important is this, that in the latter days, these two horns will re-emerge, but that's not the end of the story. They will be confederate. That's the important thing. Why has God given these two powers the same title in chapter 7 and chapter 8? Little horn. He's wanting to see that there's a connection between the two. They're going to be confederate powers. And you know, so important is that confederacy that God's typed it in a number of ways in the Bible. For example, Ahab and Jezebel, who killed the servants of God. Pilate and the Sanhedrin, who killed Christ. There was enmity between Nimrod and the seed of the woman, and it continues today. Well, how did this little horn come to power? Well, that's the story of the three horns that it plucked up. You know, I'd never really appreciated until I, you know, read the historical background to these three horns, just how strongly the angels had to pull on those four wings of heaven to bring this little horn to the zenith of its power. Did you know that the angels arranged for the Western Roman Empire to come to an end in order that this little horn might grow? That's incredible. God brought about the end of the Western Roman Empire, and he uprooted three kings to make place for this little horn. In short, this is how God made space for the little horn. So long as there were emperors in Rome, the dominion of the Bishop of Rome was stifled. God took that away in 476. He took away the emperors of Rome. The problem was it created a vacuum filled by the barbaric kings. And though some of those barbaric kings recognised the Pope, as he became called, they were Arian Christians. They believed in one God. They didn't believe, as the Pope did, in a Trinity. So long as there were barbaric kings around, the Pope's supremacy was threatened or compromised. So it was necessary to remove those three horns. So why were those three horns removed? Well, there's two pictures there. One depicts this first one here. You can see he's the Pope, Pope Leo, and he's petitioning this guy here, Genseric, who was one of the barbaric kings. Look at the change. This was 533. The Pope is in submission to this guy. By the time we get to 800, it's a very different scene. We're back to an imperial reign, but this time the Pope's not in submission. He's co-ruler with the Emperor, with the Holy Roman Emperor. So can you see that the purpose of plucking up the three horns was to do this? It was to free the Pope from the shackles of kings and emperors, to pave the way for a new form of imperial reign where the Pope would have equal power with the emperor. That was the purpose of plucking up these three horns. We won't go through this in detail, but there are some qualifications of a horn to be one of the three. And quickly, the horn had to have a king. Their uprooting had to occur in the presence of the little horn. They had to be uprooted to make way for the little horn. The little horn had to rise, the horn had to arise prior to the little horn and had to be subdued by the little horn or an agent of it. And I don't believe the Huns could have filled that bill. But there are three that do: the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards. The details of the plucking up of these three horns is in the handout, so I'm only going to treat this very briefly. The plucking up of the Vandal horn was triggered by the Vandals plundering Rome in 455. So what happened was, the Huns came into Europe, and a lot of civilizations fled the Huns. The Huns pushed the Vandals ultimately down into Africa. They established themselves in Africa, made Carthage their capital, and then from Carthage they wreaked havoc. They basically controlled all of the Mediterranean, and they eventually plundered Rome, and that really was the tipping point. Up till then they were sort of tolerated, but once they plundered Rome, the Byzantine emperor said, "Enough is enough, we're going to deal with you guys," and he did in 533 AD. It took immense resources to defeat the Vandals. In the first attempt, there was 500 or 600 ships sent. Genseric the Vandal wiped the whole lot out. You imagine what that's doing to the taxpayers in Rome. The next horn to be plucked up was the Ostrogoth. And what we're starting to see now is the increased involvement of the papacy in bringing about the uprooting of these horns. The plucking up of the Ostrogoth horn took 18 years, and Pope Vigilius, that'll do, adjured Emperor Justinian to deliver Italy from Totila the Goth. There was one more horn that yet had to be plucked up, and that was the Lombard horn. So the Roman emperors have come to an end. The Heruli and the Ostrogoths saw to that, and they established what's called in the Bible the seventh head. That was uprooted by Belisarius at the direction of Justinian. So for a period of time, the Pope was looking pretty good. He had no emperor to worry about, at least in the West, and the Vandals have been dealt with, and so have the Goths. But the problem was, he had no protector. And the Lombards, who were to the north of Italy, saw an opportunity to come down and try and take Italy. The problem was that the Pope had burnt his bridges. There'd been a schism with the emperor in the east over idolatry, and so the Pope had to turn somewhere else. He turned to Pepin. Now, the reason for putting this on the screen is to show you this. It shows you that at the time when this was written, this letter from Pope Stephen to Pepin, who was a Frank king, get a feel for the power of the Pope at this point in history. When the Lombard king Astophilus laid siege to Rome, so this is the last of the horns to be uprooted, the Lombard one, Pope Stephen wrote to Pepin, king of France, and this is what he put in his letter. Calls himself Peter. "Peter, called an apostle by Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, as through me the whole Catholic, Apostolic and Roman Church, the mother of all churches," he must have done his daily readings in Revelation 17 that day, "is founded on a rock, and to the end that Stephen, bishop of the beloved Church of Rome, and that virtue and power may be granted by our Lord to rescue the Church of God out of the hand of these persecutors, I, Peter, the apostle, conjure you, if you will not fight, you shall have no share in heaven." How's that? Would you like to receive that in the mail? Shows you the power of the Pope and the influence he had over uprooting the Lombard, the last horn. So the plucking up of the Lombard horn was a very significant thing. It introduced a new world order. Why is that? The Lombards brought about a new world order. Their threat caused the Pope Stephen to formally sever ties with the Byzantine Empire and to turn to the Franks. That's the first thing. He couldn't turn to the east because he'd already burnt his bridges there, and besides, they were having trouble militarily in the east. So he turns to the north, to the Franks. That's the first significant impact of the Lombard horn. The second impact was what resulted from their overthrow. It resulted in the world beholding for the first time a bishop invested with temporal power. The little horn was now truly diverse from the other horns. It had become a religious and civil power. So what we're saying here is this. When Pepin recovered territory from the Lombards, he gave this green area here, called the Papal States, to the Pope. But he didn't just give him the territory. He gave him power, civil power over it. And so the Pope now has something that he had never had before. He had temporal power. Okay. So that paved the way for a new era where the Pope could gain significantly increased power through an alliance that became known as the Holy Roman Empire. So in summary, I'll just quickly make reference to this. I thought it was a really interesting comment by a historian. He's not a religious historian. I'm going to just direct your attention to the words in yellow. So he's commenting on the migration of the barbaric kings into Western Europe and those that survived and those didn't. And note this comment that he makes. The Goths, Vandals, Burgundians and Lombards never took root. It's the language of Daniel chapter 7, isn't it? Okay, so let's just review the fourth beast, little horn. It was diverse from the ten kings. It's a religious power as distinct from military. It arose after the ten kings. It developed contemporary with the ten kings but gained ascendancy after them. It emerged from among them. Now, I find this really interesting because this confirms that the ten kings are Western European. So if you're asked the question, the ten toes of the image, the ten horns in Daniel chapter 7, prove to me that they're Western European. That's how you do it, because the Roman power came up in the midst of them. So the ten horns must also have been centred in Western Europe. This little horn subdued three kings. It subdued the Vandal, Ostrogoth and Lombard kings. It had the eyes of a man, and the papacy is surveillant via the Holy See, that pool of cardinals and bishops spread around the world. It was more stout than its fellows. It was appointed head of all churches. It spoke great words against the Most High. It blasphemously claimed to be God on earth. And finally, it persecuted the saints, as we said, for a period of 1260 years. I want you to put your thinking caps on again, brothers and sisters and young people, before we briefly consider the last phase of the fourth beast. This isn't going to take very long, but before we consider this last phase of the fourth beast, we need to establish a principle. Daniel chapter 2, four dominions, if you like, gold, silver, brass, iron, are all in one image. They are representative of a, how many kingdoms? One kingdom. How then do we, and we say that this represents the kingdom of men in the latter days, it's going to be one kingdom when it's destroyed. So what do we say then about Daniel chapter 7, where these four metals that are integrated are unbundled? You know, we've got a beast for the head, a beast for the chest, a beast for the belly, and a beast for the legs. This image in chapter 2 is a depiction of the kingdom of men in the latter days as an integral thing. Does that mean that in Daniel chapter 7 we don't have a representation of that latter day kingdom? The answer is yes, we do. Well, the question is, if the latter day kingdom is an incorporation of all four metals, is that kingdom depicted in Daniel 7 where the four metals are unbundled? and presented as four beasts. I hope you get my point. The question? Someone smile or say yes. Okay, the answer is yes, on this basis, that each beast engorged the previous beast, so that the fourth beast incorporates the leopard, the bear, and the lion dominions. Proof of that, Daniel chapter 7, verse 12, there were four beasts in existence at the end. How could that be? This is the answer. Similarly, in Revelation 13, verse 2, the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 is developed in Revelation 13, and it's likened to a leopard, a bear, and a lion. The fourth beast has got one more phase. It's got a lot of work to do. And it's summed up in chapter 7 by the simple words, it stamps the residue with brass claws. Oh, that tells us so much. The brass claws of the beast indicate that it will exercise dominion over all of the Grecian territory. To achieve that, it must stamp that portion of the Grecian Empire from Syria to the Indus River, which the Bible styles the residue, that was not conquered during its Roman Empire phase. That's what the brass claws signify. The residue is that Persian Empire, if you like, from Syria to the Indus River. It's got a lot of work to do. So, what's that mean to us? This is the exciting thing I find, brothers and sisters, is that the historical events in chapter 7 give us the hallmark of the fourth beast that will enable us to recognise it when it comes out of hibernation. The fourth beast isn't to be found today, but perhaps apart from the papacy. I'm going to repeat that again. The historical events of chapter 7 give us the hallmark of the fourth beast that will enable us to recognise it when it comes out of hibernation. What is that hallmark? The hallmark is that the fourth beast is the allied dominion exercised by Rome and Constantinople. Rome was religious, the religious capital, and Constantinople, the military. So this is the point. When we see the religious power in Rome confederate with the military power in Constantinople, then the time of the end is near. Is that present at the moment? You've got the Turk in Constantinople. You've got the Pope in Rome. They're not confederate powers. But there will come a time when Gog will come down and he will move his headquarters from Moscow to Constantinople. Now, this is where the interesting part is. Do we see any evidence of that confederacy taking place? Look at this. The emerging alliance between Rome and Constantinople. Putin went to see the Pope in November 2013, again in June 2015, again last year in July. What we've got forming, brothers and sisters and young people, is that alliance that we expect to see in the last days, and Daniel tells us about it. I appreciate I'm over time, brothers and sisters, but I just want to finish on this one point. Why did God allow this religious power to develop and oppress and persecute the saints for so long, for over a millennia? We can't answer that question, but what we can do is think about this. That God expected men and women to sacrifice their lives in defence of their beliefs. He is no less exacting today in what level of sacrifice he expects of us. The question is, what sacrifice are we willing to make, and does it match what he is expecting?